Thank you very much for coming out today. My name is Josh Klatskin. I'm a partner in the Clean Technology and Energy Group here at Goodwin Procter. We have about 100 lawyers who work in clean tech and energy across a variety of disciplines. And it's a strategic focus of our firm, which is one of the reasons why we're so excited to be here today, focusing on what we see as a real trend in our what our clients are interested in, which is offshore wind. We're also excited and appreciative of all the support that GE Energy and the Offshore Wind Platform Group has given to today's event. Rich Reno and his team have been great supporters of both the event and the content, and we really want to thank you guys and appreciate all that you've done. And we also want to thank all of our panelists and moderators for participating today, and really just wanted to lay out the theme for the afternoon and then let Rich get right into the keynote. We'll start out with a keynote by Rich and get an overview of the offshore wind industry, trends, where they think it's headed, and where the opportunities are going to be in offshore. Have a first panel, which is going to focus on project execution. Rich Reno from GE is going to moderate that, and it's going to feature Neil Clarkson of Wincat Workboats, Thomas Lenihan of Bechtel Power, Rick Palmer of Weeks Marine, and Todd Wynn from Garad Hassan. And these are some of the most experienced names in offshore, and they're going to share the benefit of their experience and what they've learned from operating the offshore space, and how some of those lessons learned can apply to the development of the North American market. And our final panel is going to focus on offshore from a developer's perspective. Sam Gabita from Element Partners will moderate that panel, and it will feature Michael Mattia from Fisherman's Energy, Tim Ryan from Apex Offshore, and Chris Weissman from Great Lakes Wind Energy. And that's going to really focus on what's the investment thesis for offshore, the evolution of the market, and the practical real-world dynamics of getting an offshore project off the ground. There'll be a brief break after each panel, and we'll follow the second panel with a networking reception in the room next door, and we hope you can all join us for that. So again, thanks so much for coming out today, and I'd like to introduce Rich Reno. Rich is the general manager of the offshore wind platform at GE. Prior to that, he ran the 2.5 megawatt product, which is the largest onshore product that GE has. He's also served in positions in GE Energy and hydro and thermal, both in North America and other parts of the world. And want to welcome Rich to the podium and looking forward to your address.
Thank you. Good afternoon. And I too would like to thank everybody for joining us here today. We're going to talk a little bit about offshore, kind of our views, some things we're doing, some challenges that the industry is facing, and many of the people in this room are actually working on solving together. Hopefully it'll be a great discussion. So as many of you know that are involved in the space, it's been a very exciting year for offshore wind. For the first time ever, offshore installs will be over 1 gigawatt this year. So that's great progress. And that's, the install base has doubled since 08 and tripled since 05. So, just great progress and tons and tons of announcements. I mean, if you listen to what's happening in the UK, 32 gigawatts, round three, Germany, China, just tons and tons of announcements and excitement over the space. But the reality is, if you look at the install base of offshore wind in comparison to onshore wind, it represents less than 2%. So while it's gaining a lot of momentum, it's got a lot of excitement, it's just getting started. So what that means is there's a lot of problems that need to be solved. There's a lot of opportunity in this space. if you think about it, it's been going on for about 10 years. And, it started really slow back in the late 90s, and it's been building up momentum. And a lot of that recent momentum has actually caused and also come from investment going into this space. If you look at the number of products being built out there, everybody and their brother from the wind side is trying to get into this space. You look at the investment going into vessels, both on the service side, on the installation side, and just all the investment going into the space, it's huge. And that investment is driving a lot of progress in this industry, and it's enabling some future competitiveness that we all hope to get out of the space. But there's still a lot of investment needed, particularly on the project side. If you look at the capital that's got to go into these projects to make them happen, even achieve a fraction of the targets that are out there, it's astounding. But as I said, there's a lot of excitement around it, and I'm sure it will all come with time. Oops. So, I mean, it's really today, it's all about Europe, right? If you look at it, 95% of the installs have happened in Europe. And really, those installs have happened in two countries, primarily the UK and Denmark. And if you look going forward, about 80% of the projections today are also in Europe. So that's where the market is happening today. And, you know, why, right? You've got great support schemes that have been built up over time. And the industry really struggled until those things came into place. And since they've come into place, it's really taken shape. And the other thing is it's all centering around one single body of water, the North Sea. So if you add up what's going on in the UK, you add up what's going on in Germany and some of the other countries along the North Sea, what you're talking about is an infrastructure build-out of about 50 nuke plant equivalent of energy coming from the North Sea. And just think about, you know, that for a moment. You know, 50 new plants of energy coming from offshore wind in the North Sea. And that is really driving a lot of excitement. It's driving investment in products, investments in ports, investment in infrastructure, and just, you know, driving a lot of excitement. And today, it's really being driven from the fact that you've got targets out there for these countries to achieve renewable energy penetration, and the ones leading the charge here really don't see a way to achieve those without doing offshore. So they're leading the charge. They're setting targets and incentives to make this industry grow in the hopes that, sorry, getting a signal here, you can't hear me so well, in hopes that that investment will drive the cost down and improve the competitiveness of offshore wind. And we'll talk a little bit about that because I think that's all possible. So, you know, another, you know, we are here in the U.S. and we are here on the East Coast today, but there's a lot of excitement happening in the U.S. today. Had a great conference a couple of weeks ago in New Jersey. A lot of people there from every side of this industry, on the customer side, the OEM side, the supply chain side, the government side. So there's a lot of excitement happening here in the U.S. and offshore as well. And, you know, why is that, right? And if you look at some of the fundamentals. I mean, we've got tremendous resource here in the U.S. If you look at the DOE models that they're talking about for the 20% target by 2030, they're talking, I think, like over 50 gigawatts of offshore wind capability. And if you look at some other fundamentals here in the Northeast, you've got a huge percentage of the population and a huge percentage of the electricity demand right along the East Coast. So what are your options if you want to penetrate that with renewable energy? The prospect of bringing that in from the Midwest and building transmission lines across the country has got some significant challenges on it, whereas just putting them in the right here in the Atlantic Ocean and running some cables ashore, probably a lot lower hurdle than the alternative. And you also have some very high energy prices right here in the Northeast. So in the early stages, when offshore is got some high costs, it's easier to, you know, to there's a smaller gap, let's say, in the Northeast. And you've got some states here with RPSs, which are great and driving a lot of growth in renewables. But as they look at it, it's similar to, let's say, the UK and Germany. How are you going to meet those RPS targets, if not with offshore wind? And then I think a big incentive in this environment, in the state of the economy, in the state of the world, is jobs. And offshore wind is going to drive economic development, and with that, it's going to drive jobs. But there's still some challenges ahead before that's going to happen, right? Policy, you know, the policy that's driving Europe in the UK and Germany, we don't have that at a federal level here in the U.S. New Jersey, you know, has done a fantastic job with the OREC legislation. I mean, I think you've got, you know, line of sight to some real things happening on the back of that. You know, you've got some momentum building around the Bureau of Ocean Management on the permitting side. So you've got a significant challenge there, and that today the process is very, very long, but you've got some excitement building around it. And, you know, but one of the things we've got to face as an industry is how do you get the jobs without the volume and who's going to commit to the volume without the job. So it's a little bit of a catch-22, and I know many of you in the room here are facing that challenge and working to address it. But if you look at it from the fundamentals, I mean, the demand is there, the resource is there, and the excitement is here and the capability is here to really harness that. So we see it as a tremendous emerging opportunity. And then if you think about it, it's not just about the East Coast. It's not just about the Atlantic Ocean. You know, the Great Lakes pose an exciting opportunity, but at first glance, you probably wouldn't guess that, right? The wind is perhaps a little bit less than it is in the Atlantic Ocean, but there's some other benefits that really matter if you look at this. If you look at offshore wind, the Great Lakes have good grid infrastructure. You got a lot of power plants right along the lakes anyway, so you can tap into those. And if you take Lake Erie, for example, which in our view is going to be one of the, early goers here, the fundamentals are such that the wind is relatively constant, the soil conditions in the lake, the water depth in the lake are relatively constant. So while you have a little bit of a headwind of, not the best wind resource, you have a tremendous opportunity in the standardization that could be achieved if you were to try to harness the offshore wind capability in the Great Lakes. And just on the bottom of this chart, here are some examples. And these are things that we've seen in real life. If you go in scale with a particular product, and this is something that as GE we have a lot of experience with, as we have over 15,000 of our 1.5 megawatt machines operating out there in the industry, you can get tremendous scale, and with that comes significant cost reduction, especially when you look at the differences between onshore wind and offshore wind. Where onshore wind, the balance of plant, the non-turbine scope represents a relatively small portion, but in offshore wind, it's a large portion. So, the benefits, if you can harness that energy with a consistent model, can be huge, and they can be in availability. You can have a standard service model, and some of our panelists here later will talk about that. Consistent vessel strategy, consistent access strategy, and with that you can drive improvement in the availability, which is so important in these farms. And the CapEx onshore, if you focus on the turbine, you can really control most of your cost. So if you look at it from auction off your turbine to the lowest bidder, which has some other downsides, but you're controlling a large piece of your cost. If you take that same approach on offshore, you're only controlling half of it. And while you may get learning curve from the first turbine to the next one, by the time you go to that next project, even if you have a lower cost or a more attractive cost on the turbine side, you've got to start over on the BOP. And the BOP in offshore is at least half the battle. So you got to start off with new foundations. You got to start off with new, installation vessels. So if you look at the Great Lakes and you can harness that in the right way, you could really see some incredible economies of scale in that application. And with that, in our view, you could really drive down the cost of electricity of offshore wind. So again, we're very excited about the opportunity that is presented there. China, right? Can't talk about just about any subject without mentioning China. If you looked at that first chart that I showed with the installs going in, 100 megawatts of that 1 gigawatt, a little over 1 gigawatt going in this year, is going in China. It's the only country outside of Europe that actually has operating offshore wind. And they have a wind farm that went in earlier this year. And there's another 200 megawatts in construction. And, the policy that's being driven by the Chinese government is very aggressive. But if you look at the history of what they've achieved in onshore wind, I have no reason to believe that they're not going to kind of try to achieve the same levels of success. So they're talking about 30 gigawatts of offshore wind. If you look at, but it's not all rosy, obviously, right? I mean, if you look at China, the wind is not so great, but they have a significant portion of their targeted projects at a very shallow water depth. So if you combine the lower water, shallow water with the lower wind speed, I think the economics can be favorable. But what that could drive and what that actually, in our view, will drive is kind of a specific technology where you're going after a shallow, type of technology that fits well in shallow water but can also harness lower wind speeds, but also has to have the capability of surviving typhoons. So interesting space. And we recently announced a joint venture with Harbin in China, and we think that industry is going to go. And if it's anything like it has been in offshore, or in onshore, it'll be a very, very exciting region. So, you know, something that I think is on the, you can't have an offshore discussion without talking about the economics, right? Clearly, offshore is expensive power today, and will be for some time until some of the investment that's being made catches up and some of the scale takes place. But if you just take a little history lesson here and focus on the UK, because UK has the largest percentage of the installed base today and has, you know, probably the strongest growth prospects for at least the next 10 years or so. You know, in the early days, CapEx was low because essentially people were taking onshore turbines at onshore prices and putting them in the ocean, right? The problem with that model was they were onshore turbines designed for onshore conditions, and they didn't work very well. So while the projects had the benefit of relatively low CapEx, they suffered from tremendously high OpEx and poor performance. So the net result was a lot of projects out there with marginal to negative, you know, returns. So, you know, in trying to get the industry to move forward, specifically in the UK, they upped the incentive, changed the policy, and you saw, you know, a lot of excitement. Unfortunately, a lot of excitement and a lot of volume drove tremendous constraints in the supply chain. So a lot of the value of those, of the increased incentive was sucked up in supply chain bottlenecks. The good news is it was a better class of turbines. You're starting to see some offshore pedigree come into the market. So overall, the projects benefited from that. So you see in the UK today, I think a pretty good market. And going forward, with all the investment that's going into the space, investment that OEMs are making, investment that governments are making in infrastructure and suppliers are making in the balance of plant infrastructure, you can start to see line of sight to significantly improved competitiveness of offshore wind. And, you know, we'll talk a little bit about it later here, maybe in a slide or so. But, you know, if you can drop the CapEx, if you can improve the OpEx, if you can improve the availability, these things can have significant impacts on the return. So with the investment that's going into this thing, with the learnings that have happened over the last 10 years, again, we see a lot of potential in the competitiveness to drive the cost down. And, you know, let's take a look at it. You know, this is kind of our view. It's a generic view of the cost of offshore wind versus the price of offshore wind in different markets. Now, this is estimated cost at commercial scale. This isn't going to be 10 unit project here or a 5 unit project here. This is what can be achieved with a 500 megawatt commercial scale size project. And if you look at how the cost is made up, well, there's different factors that impact the cost of offshore wind. One, distance from shore. That impacts your ability to go out there and service the turbines and keep the availability at certain levels and your cost of doing so. So that's one of the factors. And depending on where you are in the world, the market is happening at different distances from the shore. UK, relatively near shore. Germany, very far shore, for example. Water depth. If you're able to put a turbine in shallower water, it can be less expensive than putting a turbine in deeper water. So that's one of the factors that matters as well. And also wind speed. Obviously, wind speed is, you know, this wind is a real estate game to some extent. You know, you want to be where the wind blows the most. So if you throw those different factors of economics into a generic pool and you run it out, you'll see the cost varies significantly by the region and by the country. And if you add in the support schemes for investment, for example, if you look at the one on the bottom here, the federal policy that's in place today with makers and ITC is actually fits pretty well with offshore with the high CapEx. And if you factor those things in, you can see how the cost varies by region. And if you take the incentive schemes that are in place today, the UK with two rocks, the Germany with their feed-in tariff and sprint bonus, and Canada with its feed-in tariff, and you know, Denmark, et cetera, you can see that there's gaps in some markets, some favorable, some, you know, unfavorable. And where you see the most excitement today, UK, Germany, that's where the economics make the most sense. And Canada, there's a lot of excitement there with the projects in the Great Lakes. But if you go down to the U.S., where, you know, we talked about a little bit on the Great Lakes and the East Coast, you know, you could make this work. If you get the ITC extended with the you know, maker's incentive that's out there, and you could get some policy to close that gap. You got the federal government taking a big piece of it with the cost support. And if you can have the right policy like New Jersey has and the ORIC legislation, you could see this thing taking off. So in all of these markets, there's you know, a little bit on cost if you're able to do something with the technology, a little bit on the price if you're able to do something with policy to drive. You can see this thing really taking off, not just in the countries that we talked about earlier, but on a much larger scale. So, you know, obviously, you know, we're here, we're excited about the space, and we're trying to do our part to improve the competitiveness of offshore wind. And it's just a continuation on what we have done in onshore wind. And for those of you that don't know, we entered onshore wind in 2002 with the acquisition of Enron's assets. And, you know, we inherited a business that had decent technology, had good engineering skills, but it just hadn't achieved its full potential. And we inherited a fleet that was operating at about 85% availability and turbines that were decent but not that efficient. And through significant investment over the last 10 years, more or less, we have taken the availability of that fleet from 85% up to over 98%. And if you think about what that does to the economic returns for customers, it's huge. And what it does for the cost of electricity for the industry. And we've also taken the efficiency from, if you think of it in terms of capacity factor, from the high 30s to the low 50s. And again, what that has done to the economics is just allowed this industry to scale, you know, in tremendous fashion. And the majority of our installed base over the last 5 years has gone right here in the U.S., where nearly one out of two turbines that goes into the U.S. is ours. And with that has come, you know, a tremendous success by any measure. We have, you know, in fulfilling that growth, we've gone from a factory that was producing 10 turbines a week to 13 a day. And our own investment in our production facilities and our people and the investment that had to go into the supply chain in the U.S. to make that happen is astounding. Tremendous job growth, tremendous investment had to go in to make that happen. And we want to bring that experience, what we've done there, to offshore. And, you know, if you look at it, we are in wind, you know, a full-scale player. We have a 1.5 megawatt machine that is our bread and butter, coined the industry workhorse, 15,000 of those out in operation, the most installed turbine of a single type of any OEM, something we're very, very proud of. We took that learning and that capability, and we scaled it up for our latest product, the 2.5 onshore. And with that product, we're, you know, establishing a stronger foothold in Europe, where we have we won one of the largest project in Europe, which is going into Romania right now. So the largest onshore project in Europe, we won with that 2.5 megawatt machine. And in 2009, we came back and we launched that same project here in the U.S. And shortly thereafter, we announced that the 2.5 will be used on Cadenus Shepherd's Flat in Oregon, which is going to be the largest onshore wind farm in the world. So that product is achieving all of our expectations and filling a great part of our portfolio as, you know, where there's sites that require bigger turbines to capture more energy out of a specific piece of land. And offshore, what we're here to talk about today, you know, and some of you know this, some of you don't, but we were one of the early entrants into offshore wind back in, you know, the beginning of, 2000. I think we put 1.5s in Sweden. We launched the offshore program with our 3.6 megawatt machine that we later installed in Arklow. For that, we designed the turbine specifically. We developed the site. We installed the turbines, and we still own and operate those turbines today, which has been, you know, the good news is it was you know, it was our entry into the market. But at that point, we also learned that the market wasn't ready. So it was also the reason we exited. But over the last 5 years, we've been learning a tremendous amount from that installed wind farm. And we're taking all that knowledge and applying it into what we're doing today in offshore. And services is a big aspect for onshore wind. The fuel is free. The investment in onshore wind, it happens in the CapEx and putting the turbines in place. So once you have those assets in place, they have to run. And services is essential to make that happen. We've built a tremendous infrastructure here in the U.S. with, you know, nearly one out of two turbines being ours. We've put an infrastructure in place that is second to none. And we're able to get parts to these sites within, you know, 24 hours if they need it. And we've got remote diagnostic center right up here in upstate New York, where we monitor all our turbines here in the U.S., as well as we have the capability of monitoring them in Asia and Europe. And we analyze that data every day. And, you know, service is something that we're building our brand on. Took the fleet from 85% to 98%, and we're going to take that same process, push it into offshore. And we're also in the solar business. We acquired a Crescent Silicon business 5 or 6 years ago. We've since exited that. We've entered into thin film with investment in PrimeStar. We had some announcements a couple of weeks ago where we are pushing the technology on thin film to very high levels, and we expect to be a leader in that space as we go forward as well. So we're a full-scale player in the renewable space, and offshore is kind of our latest venture. And, you know, we talked about this a little bit. Arklow, we put those turbines in the water in 2004. And, you know, we affectionately call it the University of Arklow because we've just learned so much of operating those over the years. And some of the people in this room have been a part of that learning with us. And some of the key things that we learned is, you know, you have to be able to access those turbines because even the best turbine in the world needs maintenance. And, you know, you also have unplanned events, so you have to be able to access those turbines. But you have to have a design that has a higher capability of entitlement for availability than onshore. Taking an onshore turbine, scaling it up, and putting it in the water is not a good proposition, which is what we did at Arklow, and we learned from that. And specifically, you know, gearboxes can be a challenge, and we'll talk a little bit more about that on the next page, but we've lived through it at Arklow. We've had gearboxes fail at the absolute worst time, where it's September, the gearbox fails. You're just getting ready to go into the windiest season of the year. You can't get a gearbox. You wait through the winter because you can't get out there in the stormy months. You go out in the spring, you got your jackup vessel, you pay to mobilize it, you go out there, a storm comes, you got to take all the guys into the port, let them sit there for a week. While you're paying daily for that jackup vessel, you go back out, you complete the exercise. Before you know it, it costs you $5 million to change a gearbox. So, you know, you got to have these things designed so that they run reliably. And in the event that you do have to go out there and service them, you got to be able to do it cost effectively. So we are an owner of offshore wind, an owner and operator, and we're taking that view as we go forward with our offshore product. And, you know, this is a big piece of our value story, so I wouldn't be doing myself or GE justice if I didn't talk about it a little bit more. If you think about it, even a great gearbox has a cost. You have to go out there and maintain it. You have they have oil that needs to be changed every couple of years. They have filters that need to be changed. And every piece that you add to a turbine has the opportunity for failure. So there's maintenance and availability issues associated with that. And that's just a good, healthy, average gearbox. There's costs associated with that. And if that gearbox fails, you gotta get a new gearbox. You gotta mobilize a vessel to go take the gearbox down. Not to mention the revenue you're losing the whole time that thing is down. And you've got, you know, a significant cost, you know, and we'll say $1.5 million on the average to low side. But like I said, we've seen it be significantly higher than that. And, you know, what happens, and this is my favorite analogy, what happens if the transmission goes in your car at 100,000 miles? It's a tough decision. Do you like the car? Do you not like the car? Is the rest of it good? You know, you really have a tough decision to make. If the gearbox goes in your offshore wind turbine, year 15 or beyond, depending on where you are, because the economics play a big part in it, you might not have a positive NPV in replacing it. So then what you've just done is shorten the life of your, you know, tremendous asset that's sitting out there. So one of the big focuses that we've had is you can't have a gearbox offshore. We're going forward with our direct drive design. And, you know, I think you don't have to look too far in the press to see that there's a lot of others trying to do the same thing today. So, you know, what is it? You know, this is a picture that came off the cover of Popular Science when we launched the turbine earlier this year. We were real happy to get that coverage on the machine, but they saw it as a very innovative design in the industry. You know, it is gearless, so all those issues with the gearbox are gone. Now, the downside is we do have a very large generator out there, but the design of this generator is such that it's modular. So in the event that you do have a failure, you can actually replace those segments of the generator without an expensive jack-up barge and all the trouble associated with that. You can do it more or less in situ. And this turbine was designed, and I sat on a panel a couple of months ago and listened to others say that their onshore and offshore designs are the same. Well, I can tell you, ours isn't. We've learned what it's like to take an onshore machine and put it in the water, and we won't do it again. This one is specifically designed for purpose offshore. Redundancy, reliability, in situ repair capability. This is a design that was done by the company we acquired from Norway and Sweden. And if you think about the cultures of those two countries, they spend their whole lives in the North Sea, harnessing oil and gas and, you know, going back to the Vikings, however far you want to look at it. So this is a culture and an engineering institution that is comfortable with the offshore environment. And, you know, if you look what we've done in our onshore business, what we're very proud of, we're taking that technology that we've proven out over our unprecedented fleet, combining it with this design that in our view is second to none, and it's built for purpose capability. And that's what we're going forward with. And, you know, there's a bunch of these things running out there today. They've been running for 5 years. So while others are coming out with their direct drive capability, ours has been there for 5 years, and we're just continuing the evolution, just like we've done on our 1.5 and 2.5. So we're real excited about the technology that we're bringing to this space. We see this as a very scalable technology and something that will help drastically reduce the cost of electricity offshore. But it's not just about the turbine. We talked about it a little bit before. You know, the turbine onshore is the biggest piece. Offshore, it's only half the equation. And this is a, you know, representative view, but you can see if you look at the LCOE, you got the turbine and the BOP making up the biggest piece, and then you got your OPEX on the top. And if you just focus on the BOP, installation is huge. You're talking about a lot of vessels, and we'll talk about that in a minute. The foundation is about 30% of that cost. And then you've got cables that you also have onshore, but you've got to bury these things in the ocean. The distance is much longer. You've got substations that are scary. I mean, 2,500 tons. I mean, these are huge lifts, huge pieces of equipment. You got substation onshore and you have substations offshore. So if you look at it, the turbines are typically two times as big offshore. The wind farms are three times as big. The OPEX is three times as important. So you've got all of these factors coming into play. So the turbine, we're doing our best to take that piece down. But collectively, we've got a lot of work to do on driving the other piece of it. So installation, you know, it is very complex. And it's because each wind farm is somewhat different. You have far from shore, you have near shore, you have big turbines, you have smaller turbines, you have strong winds, not so strong winds. So if you just look at these three examples, a 60 megawatt project in Germany, 26 vessels used simultaneously, 210 project in Denmark, 300 people, 25 vessels. And then look at a 300 megawatt project in the UK, they don't use five primary vessels. So it comes down to what problem does your wind farm propose that you have to go out and solve? And then let's face it, there is an infinite capacity in these types of vessels and this type of equipment to build these wind farms. So what instruments are available to you when you go build it? I don't know which one of these was the best model, but the fact that they vary quite widely just gives you, you know, some insight as to the challenge that we have to solve. And, you know, put it into perspective, if you're able to take 1 hour out of the installation of a 100-unit wind farm and you apply that times the daily rate for some of these installation vessels, that's $1.5 million an hour, you know, just happened, right? I mean, so if you can take that out of every installation, I mean, the returns are huge. And you look at the complexity, some pictures here, and we'll talk about a little more detail. You've got a variety of vessels out there. The foundation type, depending on what you're trying to do and the constraints that you have, you may pick a completely different foundation type. There's several varieties going in today. What wind turbine are you going to use? How are you going to solve the substation issue? Do you have a vessel that can do a 2,500-ton lift, or do you have to split that up, or do you have to have a wind farm that's close enough to shore that you can put the substation on shore? A lot of challenges that need to be solved. A lot of investment going into the space, a lot of intelligence, and a lot of smart people trying to solve these problems, but there's still a long way to go, and a tremendous opportunity. So just take a look at some of these things, and these pictures are just, you know, I love showing my kids these pictures because they're just impressive, and they're scary at the same time. But, you know, a monopile, I think, is the workhorse of the industry today. Well, there's still some challenges if you read the press on some of the projects going into Europe. You're talking about several hundred ton pile, which is a big tube that you got to get a big hammer and drive into the ground. It may be the most cost effective, but there's issues associated with that. Can you do it during the spawning period of the fish? How does that noise impact the mammals and the fish? And if you're near shore, how does that impact the people on shore? And where are the vessels to install things of this nature? Gravity foundations, a lot of promise. I think there's a lot of excitement around this segment, but still challenges. How do you move these massive pieces of equipment? How many vessels are there in the world that look like that one in the center picture? And jackets. I mean, jackets are interesting because they're lighter than a monopile. You look at the structure of it; it looks like a cell tower or something that you've seen before, but welding them together and the precision and the way that needs to be done can be very expensive. But if you're in deep water, you can't use a monopile, or maybe you can't use a gravity solution. So you have to use a jacket. So again, each one of these things has tremendous merit in their own specific application. And I think there's a lot of investment going into them, but still a long way to go to get these things to the industrialization that we've been able to achieve onshore and drive the cost down. So something that's probably obvious you think about it, but it wouldn't be the first thing that comes to your mind, is what's the port infrastructure like to support building out these wind farms? You can read things in the press every day of this port is importing blades or turbines for this onshore wind farm, but look at the vessels that are kind of going to need to come in and out of a port to deliver components or, inbound or outbound for a wind farm, and what types of vessels are going to need to come in there. Some of the issues could be, how big is it? You got a 500 megawatt wind farm. Do you have any idea how much space is needed to lay down that equipment? Well, I don't either, but I can tell you it's a lot, right? It's tremendous. And we're going to run into bottlenecks. You look in Europe, in the UK, many of these ports are used for containers. Right. And there's tons of containers lying in there. But try moving around a 300 ton nacelle. You can't do it. The trucks will sink in the ground. So what's the infrastructure of these ports like? Try bringing in a deep seawater vessel into these ports. You can't do it because the ports aren't deep enough. And if you go in river, try getting these things under a bridge. A lot of them want to be installed as much as possible as you take them out to the ocean to minimize your time out there. Can you do it? Do you have power lines in the way? Do you have bridges that you have to go under? So, solving this problem is going to require some infrastructure build out too, as these ports ready themselves for this eventual build out. And I mean, it could be massive. The economics here, the logistics here are tremendous. So a lot of work needs to go into this as well. And these are the great pictures to show. I mean, you look at some of these vessels, even the best turbine needs to be maintained, right? And that's service vessels. And let's face it, even if you have the best design, there are unplanned events. And these vessels can also be used for installation, but you need something to service those turbines in the long term. And, you've got multiple types. You've got a jack-up vessel that can, self-propel itself out to the wind farm, jack itself up for stability and do the work. You have let's say, semi-jackups. These are leg-stabilized structures. And you have jack-up barges that need a tugboat or some other means to drag them out there. But, again, a lot of these things will be needed in the installation phase of these projects, but also in the service phase. So, again, it comes down to, as you're servicing these things, what is the problem? Do you have to go out and do fleet-wide, retrofit or preventative maintenance, which in some cases will be required on these things, or do you have an emergency type situation? You know, so what is the problem that you need to solve, and what are the tools available to you to solve it? The oil and gas industry has a pickup here. A lot of these things are going to go service that. In the last couple of years, I think they've been doing less there, so they've been available. But this is a relatively, or maybe significantly, constrained industry, and these aren't small CapEx investments. So these are big investments. These are big pieces of equipment. And it's not just about the vessel. You can have a vessel, but you need to be able to operate it efficiently. So it takes experienced crews, and those are in short supply as well. So this is a challenge that the industry has to solve. So even if you have the best turbine, like, let's say, a GE turbine, and you don't need those jackup vessels, you still have to service them. You have to get your guys out there to do planned maintenance. And, you know, again, we've taken great pain to try to limit that. We have a push in the cycle as far as we can, but you do still need to go out there and maintain these things. And again, but what is the problem that you need to solve? Do you have a project that is relatively close to shore, like a lot of the ones that have been built today, in which case you've got the benefit of the learnings that have happened today in Europe and the UK and Germany and Denmark? And, you know, some of the people that are very familiar with the space are here today. What problem are you trying to solve? Are you trying to service a small wind farm? Are you trying to serve a large wind farm? How many people does it need to carry? What's the capacity of that vessel to carry parts and et cetera? How many turbines is it going to service? And what port are you going to service them from? Do you have a port where you can keep this vessel nearby so that you can operate them at a low cost? And as this industry builds out and you have NIMBY issues where it forces you to go farther and farther offshore, then what do? Some of these projects in Germany and the UK are 100 kilometers offshore or more. Is it practical in that case to bring people in and out every day? Probably not. So then you start looking at solutions like floating hotels. You know, do you take a boat, park it out there, park it out there and just rotate your guys on and off that vessel and bring feeder vessels back and forth for the supplies and the people on a refresh? Or do you go after helicopter access? I mean, these things have to have helicopter access, at least in our view, for safety reasons. In the event that something happens, you have to get out there. But does that become a cost-effective means for servicing some of these things? These are all things that are being talked about and implemented in varying degrees, but this is a big piece of one of the problems that needs to be solved as this industry goes to mainstream. I think I'm about on time. I hope I didn't bore you to death, but from our view, this is a very exciting industry. There's a lot that's happened in the last year, and there's a lot that's going to happen over the next few years. It's a small segment today, although it's doubling and tripling over the years. It still represents less than 2%, but that's going to change. The excitement is global. China, France, Canada, East Coast, Great Lakes. I mean, this is happening around the world, and some little changes in technology and little changes in support scheme can really make that go a long way. The turbine technology is maturing. I mean, we have the benefit of a vibrant onshore industry that we can learn from, although, that you do need to have some different applications. But again, that's only half the answer. So I think the OEMs are taking this one on, and there's a ton of investment going into that. It's only half the answer. The BOP and the installation of the 3 gigawatts that's been installed, most of it's been done a unique way. So the right process is still out there trying to be solved. So it's in the early days. It's ripe for investment. It's ripe for opportunities. And it is a big piece of the equation. So, the challenges are many, hopefully not, too many that we can't solve them. But innovation is the key. It's been the key in the technology for onshore. It'll be the key for technology offshore. This is something that I think is very real. It's attracting a lot of investment if you look at what's going into it, significant investment going into the space. But a lot more is needed if we're going to solve the challenge and make this thing take off to the way I think we all want it to do. So we want to solve those challenges, and I think in doing so, we're going to create a lot of opportunities. That's all I had.